Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Chip Conley, strategic advisor to Airbnb, best-selling author, about his latest book, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. And you can learn more at chipconley.com, chipconleyoneword.com. Life expectancy has grown 30 years in the U.S. since 1900, from 47 to 77. And society is finally waking up to the potential and the rich wisdom being mined during this later period of life. If you're 55 now and may very well live another 40 years, this means that 52% of your adult life is still ahead. So at the same time that we're living longer, though, the rapid transformations of technology are changing the nature of work so that we may struggle to keep up. We have five generations in the workplace right now for the first time ever. 40% have a boss who is younger than they are, and it's projected that that number will be over 50% by 2025. And though we take such ideas for granted now, adolescence and retirement were both 20th century inventions. Chip Conley proposes a new stage, the modern elder, for people who possess both wisdom and curiosity, who are searching for meaning, not retirement. Chip Conley disrupted his favorite industry twice. At age 26, he founded Joie de Vivre Hospitality, transforming an inner-city motel into the second-largest boutique hotel brand in America. After 24 years as CEO, he sold it, and soon the young founders of Airbnb asked him to help with their promising startup. Chip served as Airbnb's head of global hospitality and strategy for 4 years, and today acts as the company's strategic advisor for hospitality and leadership. He's the author of 5 books, including Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow, and Emotional Equations, Simple Steps for Creating Happiness and Success in Business and Life, and his latest, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. Welcome, Chip Conley, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Sunday, May 19th. Chip, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we end up talking about. And I usually ask about a guest's path to the work they're doing today. But in your case, I feel your path is half of the story of what we're talking about. So feel free to take your time telling it. Feel free to go way back, mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, and I may break in now and then with questions or comments along the way.
Sure. So I grew up in Long Beach, California, and then moved up to Northern California to go to college at Stanford, and I went to the Graduate School of Business there to get my MBA. Along the way, I knew that I wanted to do something that was, you know, making a difference in the world, but probably through the vehicle of business. I originally thought politics was what I'd be interested in terms of going into government and trying to make a difference there. But having, you know, worked as an intern on Capitol Hill and on a couple presidential campaigns, I guess I just sort of figured that the place I could make a bigger difference, you know, in a smaller kind of way, bigger difference in terms of my impact, but in a maybe localized way, was actually going into business. And I started my real estate firm, my own company, my own hotel development company, a couple of years out of Stanford Business School at age 26. My mentors at that point were people like my dad, as well. Although I was, you know, I sometimes was at war with him because we have very different skills, you know. And I think he wanted me to be a carbon copy of him, and I was a much more creative type of person, like trying things that were a little bit more unique. And I was fascinated by the idea of boutique hotels, which were just getting off the ground in the mid-1980s. I started a company, and I called it Joie de Vivre, because I felt like the mission statement of the company should also be embedded in the name. And Joie de Vivre is French for joy of life. So our mission was to create joy for both our employees and our customers. I ran that company for 24 years. It became the largest independent hotel company in California, the second largest boutique hotel company in the United States. We created 52 boutique hotels. And then in the bottom of the Great Recession, I just had an awakening that said to me, like, you know, I can't be doing this any longer. It had been a calling for a long time, and it really turned into a dreary job overnight. And I felt like I was in handcuffs, and I really needed to get out of there. And so I ultimately sold the company and wasn't really sure what was next in my life. There's a great movie, The Intern, with Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway. Robert De Niro at some point in the film says he's a 70-year-old intern who's going to be interning for 34-year-old CEO Anne Hathaway. And he says, musicians don't retire. They quit when there's no more music left inside of them. So I knew I still had music inside of me at age 52, but I wasn't really sure where I was supposed to share it. And that's about the time that the three young millennial founders of Airbnb approached me to join them 6.5 years ago to help take their small little home sharing tech startup and turn it into a global hospitality brand.
Did they have that big an ambition at that point?
They did, very much so. I think their ambition was bigger than their processes to mm-hmm. actually get to mm-hmm. that ambition, and that was part of what I could do. You know, what was interesting is they were very talented. They are very talented, but two of them were designers, and so they were in the business of thinking about design and creating website design, for example. Mm-hmm. And then the other was an engineer. So none of them had any business experience or entrepreneurial experience or hospitality or travel industry experience.
Wow.
So part of my role was to come in and help infuse some of that there. And it was a great experience. I mean, like the part that was really amazing was the fact that I didn't realize this when I said yes, that I would feel as much the intern as I would the mentor. Mm-hmm. Robert De Niro became the 70-year-old intern for the young CEO, Anne Hathaway, but ultimately he became her mentor as well. As for me, I came in to be Brian Chesky's mentor, the young CEO, who was, I was 52, he was 31. But I became the intern as well because, sort of the opposite of De Niro, because he went from intern to mentor, I went from mentor to intern, because I had never worked in a tech company before. So right. One of the things I had to really be open to was being the dumbest person in the room around things that I didn't really have any experience with. And so the whole idea of, you know, yes, I could apply all of my hospitality industry experience to Airbnb, which was a company in the hospitality business, but Airbnb was a completely different kind of hospitality company than a boutique hotel company. We were not in the bricks and mortar business. We did not have maids or housekeepers. In fact, the people providing the service to our guests were not our employees. It was these hosts around the world.
Right. I've heard you tell the story where you thought that the product was the places people stayed, and someone said, that's not the product at Airbnb.
Yeah, you know, I thought when someone, there's a guy named Joe Bot, he was the chief product officer, and I said, Brian, I whispered to him, who's this chief product officer? I'm in charge of the product. I thought, because isn't our product the homes and the apartments? And Brian looked at me like I was dumber than a doorknob. And he said, the product is the website, you know, or our software applications. And I just didn't, I mean, I didn't have any background to understand that lingo. So the good news is that I was open to becoming both curious and wise. So I had the wisdom and they wanted that. But I had to be the beginner's mind and being curious. And at times that meant I asked questions that might have seemed dumb, but they could occasionally identify blind spots in the company that others hadn't seen. And so so in some ways, my beginner's mind actually helped us to understand how do we need to shift some of the things we were doing.
Let me ask a question. I've heard you tell this story before and read it, so I kind of know where we're going. But one thing that I hadn't thought about before was, at this point, 52, having sole joie de vivre, you're able to have beginner's mind. Do you think 10 years earlier you could have?
I probably not. No, I think what's really interesting in life is that we underestimate how much change is ahead of us, or how prepared we are for change. There's a beautiful TED Talk by a guy named Dan Gilbert. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing he was able to point out in that TED Talk was that at all age ranges, people underestimate how much change is ahead of them in their next 10 years. And so No, I think when I needed to sell my company, it came as a revelation, it came as a surprise, and it also came as a relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you'd asked me a few years earlier, I would have said, listen, I'm going to run this company until I'm 80 years old.
Right. And I'll be the best person to do that because I know what it is and right. All that stuff, all that knowing that, mm-hmm. that you held 10 years earlier. So you've got the beginner's mind. You're there. You tell a story actually about you're in a meeting observing and the guy running the meeting turns to you and asks you a question that floors you. Can you tell that?
The wizard who was running the meeting turned to me and asked, "Chip, if you shipped a feature and no one used it, did it really ship?" as someone who has zero technical background and has never been in a tech company before, on my third day to be in a room full of a dozen engineers half my age, and to have the leader of the meeting, 25 years old, leader of the meeting, turn to me and ask that question, and me look at him like, I have no idea what you're talking about. What does it mean to ship a feature?
Exactly.
And I, in fact, said to him, Chip is in deep ship, because I don't know what it means to ship a feature. In essence, I was having to out myself as, you know, someone who just had no clue what this tech lingo was about.
Yeah, I just wanted people to get a sense of how, you know, I mean, see, now sort of I think it's 6 years later and people go, well, I've kind of heard that. But this 6 years ago, this stuff was, you know, this is the beginning of Airbnb, the beginning of Uber, the beginning of the sharing economy. This is all brand new stuff. You found that what you brought in your role as mentor, when you thought what you were bringing was the hospitality experience, the business experience, it actually turned out to be something a little deeper.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. I think what's so interesting is that I was supposed to come in and help them. I was supposed to help Brian understand how to run the company, and I think I definitely did that, but it wasn't so. It wasn't as simple as okay. What does the org chart look like? It had a lot more to do with how do you actually compose yourself as a leader, and how do you understand emotional intelligence as a leader? How are you an emotionally intelligent leader that inspires your people? And then strategically, you know, I would not ask to be the head of global hospitality and strategy. I was just going to be the head of hospitality. But within 3 weeks, I had become the head of global hospitality and strategy and learning and development and business development and business travel and landlord partnerships. And it ended up becoming a very long run-on sentence. And it was perfectly fine, to be honest with you, the fact that I was I could use what I'd learned over time and apply it in a new place was very invigorating for me. And the fact that instead of being seen as this 52-year-old dinosaur amongst a place where the average age was 26, I really appreciated that they wanted me there. And I say that, you know, we created a mutual mentorship relationship. Often it was them teaching me DQ, digital mm-hmm. intelligence, mm-hmm. and me teaching them EQ, emotional intelligence.
Yeah, and I imagine there are young people who are precocious at emotional intelligence, but that is one of those skills, talents, aptitudes that grows with age, isn't it?
Yes. You know, your IQ doesn't typically grow as you get older. It's sort of a static number. It doesn't change much. EQ, on the other hand, does get better. It can. That doesn't mean everybody's EQ grows, but one of the things that happens as we get older is we have more self-awareness. We also create pattern recognition, which is another way of describing wisdom. Pattern recognition around ourselves and others and our emotions. And as such, we get much better at being able to be a social being in the world. And the thing that's funny about tech companies is we think of these tech companies as almost like there's these robots in the tech companies running the tech companies. No. Tech companies are full of humans. So, you know, they're not B2B businesses, they're not B2C, they're not A to Z, they're H to H, human to human businesses. And yet most of the people in tech companies have had very little psychology training or leadership or, you know, management training, and they're technical experts at what they do and they're really good at it. But that doesn't necessarily mean they know how to run a meeting.
Yeah.
Or develop a process of creating motivation and inspiration for the people who work for them. So a lot of what I did was focused on that.
Yeah. I can imagine, by the way, I know people working at startups. I've been involved in them. Even the ones who say, you know, I've got to learn that stuff and I could use a little therapy. But as soon as we, you know, open the company, as soon as we finish this beta, as soon as we get to 2.0 or 3.0, I'll take some time and do that. That would be my guess is what's happening.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. And so you also, you found that a couple of things. One, that pattern recognition gave you a skill that was beyond the emotional intelligence part, right? You say that you could get the gist of things quicker.
You know, I think what's interesting about the human brain is what we know very well is that when we're young, it's growing quickly. Our brain grows. And one of the things that's quite noticeable in our early adulthood is our recall and our memory are amazing. As we get older, recall, memories, and speed of thinking actually slows down. And we know that. And that's in sort of the knock against older people is, like, you know, they don't recall things quite like they used to. But the thing that a lot of people don't know about the human brain is that as you age, your brain does shrink a little bit, and you start learning how to do the left brain, right brain tango, which is what I mean by that is you get more adept at being able to move from one side of the brain to the other, which means you actually are not just so focused on a singular sort of logical thinking or artistic thinking. You can weave that in together, and what that means is you can see synthetically the big picture. You can connect to the dots. You're a holistic and systemic thinker. Why is that valuable? Well, gosh, when you've got a company that's growing really quickly and everybody tends to be exceptionally focused on the thing of the moment,
mm-hmm.
You could use someone who's sort of taking a step back or going 30,000 feet in the air and being able to see the forest and not just the set of the trees. And so that's really what part of what my role was to often help us elevate our look and thinking about where we were going as a company. It was beautiful because that was something I think I brought to the table because I had decades of experience and maybe my brain sort of is able to sort of connect the dots a little bit more easily.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was something I hadn't heard before, and it makes sense. And it really, I mean, yeah, if you've got a bunch of people who are going full speed ahead, they've got to keep their eye on the ball in front of them. And I can see where it doesn't even begin to train you for that other, because you've got to have that piece. So you've got to have your focus so much on that piece. What led you to reduce your role at Airbnb?
Well, it's funny. I never thought I was going to have a full-time role there. I agreed to 15 hours a week back in early spring 2013. And within 3 weeks, it had become, instead of 15 hours a week, it was 15 hours a day. And I saw that I was at a crossroads. Either I was going to say, yes, I'm going to sign up for a full-time gig here, and I'm going to have to figure out how to deal with the rest of my calendar, because I didn't have space in my life for a full-time job, or I was going to have to leave, because doing it halfway wasn't going to work too well. So I completely changed my life and really dedicated myself for 4 years. But about 2.5 years into those four years, I did say to the founders, listen, I have dedicated a lot here. I'm doing 60 to 70, 80 hours a week. And there's a lot of things in my life I've had to put on hold. And I want to be able to sort of go back to that. So in the next year and a half, let's move me to a place where I get to a status where I am just an advisor as opposed to a full-time leader in the company. And that's what we did. And that, you know, that was partly by just personal choice. You know, and for a guy who created a company and called it Joie de Vivre, it's, you know, Joie de Vivre is important to me too. I wanted some joy of life. And I had got a huge amount of joy helping to lead the company. But one of the things that's true of young startups is it sort of, it dominates the life of everybody in the company. And it's almost like they don't, and because many of the people in the company don't have families yet, are not married, don't have children, et cetera. There's an element of, you know, your whole life is thrown into just this company. And later in life, a lot of us don't want to necessarily have the singularity of focus for years on end. And so that was, you know, part of the reason I ultimately got to a place where I moved to more of an advisor role.
Mm-hmm. I will share, I've been working on a startup, and after about a year, I said, I'm going to pull back. I don't want to be involved in nearly as many decisions. Let's call on me when I'm needed. And so I very much relate. Now, what I also get is that you're a writer. This is your fifth book. My guess is at the point at which you're reducing your role at Airbnb, there's a book percolating.
You know, it's interesting. Yes, there was a moment about 2 years into being at Airbnb that I started being called the modern elder, and I started thinking, wow, this is weird. I had no idea when I was joining that I would sort of start thinking about what does it mean to have this intergenerational collaboration, and what does it mean to have this new kind of a modern elder who is as focused on being relevant as being, you know, revered. And but it was about 3 years in that I started actually making some notes to it, and then at 4 years in, that's when I started writing the book, and it took about 6 months to write the book, and then, you know, within a year, it had been published, and it was out and became a bestseller. So it's been out for about 9 months now.
And that is the book, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. So let's shift now to I started writing a book. Well, at that point, you'd been doing this 60-70 hours a week at Airbnb. So at that point, you kind of threw yourself into learning about what you knew either didn't exist, needed to exist, or you were going to find it, that information. Talk just a little bit about your search.
You know, I think the process, my search for the book, you mean?
Yeah, other words, the book is partially, there's your experience, but then there's the whole thing about how, I mean, one thing I've heard you point out is that adolescence was coined, 100 years ago?
115 years ago.
Right, right. But there's nothing after that. There hadn't been any new stage kind of since then.
Yeah, so it was interesting. As I did a little bit more of my research, you know, we all know that the idea of the elder in Western society, especially in the U.S., has been a long path towards disintegration in terms of their role in society, and that's fine. You know, it's a more and more power going to younger people, and as we moved from an agrarian to an industrial society, we went from the people who cared about land wisdom, which is the elders, the farmers, to the brawn of, you know, industrial, and then the brain of the technological era. So adolescence is a life stage that was created 115 years ago, at least coined 150 years ago. In 1904, when that book Adolescence came out, prior to that, frankly, anybody past puberty, say age 13, was perceived as being an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people got married young. People went to, you know, they started working in the coal mining factories at age 13 or 14, and they were in the industrial factories. And that book, Adolescence, helped people to see that maybe adulthood should be 18, not earlier. And so that was a major pivotal shift. And I learned about that as I was writing the book. Similarly, I learned that a few decades ago, there was a premise that middlescence, not adolescence, but middlescence, was the era of midlife. And there's a whole bunch of things in midlife that suggest that this is a period of time when people go through hormonal and emotional changes, transitions, except for when we're in middlescence and midlife, we don't get a whole lot of social support because we're adults. we're not, you know, whereas when you're in puberty, you have all of the support from family, from, you know, school counselors, Boy Scouts, sporting teams. You have a lot that helps to support you going through a difficult time. But we don't have that in midlife so much. And so that was one of the things I started to think about is, why is it that we have a midlife crisis? And why is it that, you know, the suicide rate, especially for men in their 40s and early 50s, is actually now the highest of any age bracket in U.S. society. So what is it about this period of life that seems to be people are struggling through? And I started writing the book with that in mind, that this is a book that's not just about how to work in a tech company in your 50s,
right,
but this is a book that helps people to understand how to stay relevant and be relevant later in life, especially in a world where there is a growing amount of ageism. So all of those were factors, and I interviewed about 150 people. All of that ultimately led me to getting to the place where I decided I would create something called the Modern Elder Academy, which is the world's first midlife wisdom school, down in Cabo. It's an hour north of Cabo San Lucas, in Baja California Sur, which is in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a three-acre campus. And it's been really, really successful. And so all I know is, you know, people come on a Sunday, they leave on a Sunday. And what's been amazing is how we have learned the sincere thirst that people have, typically between about age 45 and 65, for connecting with other people and talking about and learning how they shift their mindset to be a little bit more aspirational about aging and how they can shift what they've learned, mining their mastery and repurposing it in new ways. And so it's been an amazing experience. We've been fortunate enough to be on the cover of the Sunday New York Times, Sunday Los Angeles Times, cover of the Southwest Airlines magazine back in January. So it's certainly, because it's new, it's getting a lot of attention.
Right. Let me just tell people, this is Free Form, a World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chip Connelly. He's a strategic advisor to Airbnb, best-selling author. His latest book is Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. He's just told you about the Modern Elder Academy, which he began and only recently moved from beta, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you can learn more about all of this at chipconnelly.com. Let's go in a little bit more, because the stuff that I find very juicy in what you're talking about, pardon the pun if there is one, is the stuff about the caterpillar and the butterfly, about the liminal stages in growth of as we see in caterpillar to butterfly. But you're saying those adolescence and midlescence are liminal stages in humanity. What does that mean?
Well, so to be liminal, you know, we know the caterpillar to butterfly journey basically is this. There are three stages. There's a caterpillar that gets all plump and juicy, eating leaves. Then it actually spins itself a chrysalis cocoon. And then actually it enters the cocoon and it liquefies. But it actually, within the caterpillar, there were these things called the imaginal discs. The imaginal discs are the thing within it, the seed within it, that actually allowed it to convert into being a colorful butterfly that can fly. And ultimately it emerges from the cocoon and a completely different, you know, kind of being or insect. I don't know if a butterfly is an insect, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So it has three phases. There's the caterpillar and the butterfly, or the one and three. The middle phase is the gooey phase of being in the cocoon. That's liminal. To be liminal is to be in transition. Generally speaking, when we're in transition, it's gooey, it's not pretty, and it's, you know, just like in the middle of puberty, you start having acne and you're a little awkward and you've grown too much and you've outgrown clothes and you're just sort of a little bit sometimes socially awkward. And all of those things are part of what happens in a liminal period. The problem for a lot of people is they don't realize that liminality is life. It's transitions are part of life. And so you're not, even in adulthood, even in your 50s or 60s, you're not always going to look like perfect. You're gonna actually be awkward. And so helping people to see that and to see that that is natural allows people to use more of a growth mindset. So there's two kinds of mindsets, a fixed and a growth mindset. If you take a fixed mindset toward the world, you tend to focus only on those things you can win and you're successful at. But that sort of means you play in a small sandbox because you don't try things that, you know, you're not going to be very good at. And that ends up limiting what you can do in your life. If you take a growth mindset, you're not focused on winning, you're focused on learning. And if you're focused on learning, that means you actually get better with time at things. And so a lot of us, as we get older, get more of a fixed mindset because we don't want to look stupid doing things. We don't want to look stupid learning how to surf at age 58 like I have, or learning Spanish at 58 like I have. And I wish I'd learned my Spanish and my surfing when I was in my teens, but I didn't. I learned French, and I was playing water polo, and I should have, I could have gone and learned how to surf on a board, but I didn't. I learned how to body surf. So bottom line is being open to change and transition and being in that awkward transitional state is part of life, and it's part of living a fulfilled life.
One thing that occurs to me, Chip, is that adolescence, as difficult as it is, because it's the first time sort of that we're grappling with the feeling that we should have more authority than we do, we should have more power than we do, all of those sorts of things. Still, we've never, at the age of adolescence, been on top. We've never thought we knew it all. It seems to me that this midlife liminality is really more challenging because we've established a lifestyle, an ego that prides itself on having power and knowing what it's doing and so on. And you know, we've had an experience with one, and now we've got to begin to give that up.
Yes. No doubt about it. The idea that our ego in some ways is our primary operating system for living really defines the first half of our life. I believe quite strongly that the ego actually serves us well in terms of actually individuating us and helping us to understand that we are a unique being in the world. That's what, in fact, in childhood, that was really important. But it can be quite constraining, almost like the ego is the cocoon that we're supposed to actually break out of.
Mm.
And I've never thought of it that way before, but I'm going to ponder that a little bit more. What if the ego was the cocoon? And what we're supposed to break out of is something that actually can fly like a soulful butterfly. And I think that that's really interesting that we would imagine that if you stay in the ego, confines of the ego, it will actually keep you in a relatively dark place.
Yeah.
When in fact there's the opportunity to transcend it, which suggests that you don't let your ego get in the way of your learning or of your loving or of your willingness to go out and try new things.
Right, of your vulnerability, really, right? Because every time you try something new, whether it's learning something new, being with someone new, trying something new, you have to accept vulnerability that maybe you'd gotten good at not needing.
Mm-hmm.
And one other metaphor or image that you use briefly is the one of rites of passage. Can you talk about how that fits here? And then I know you've got to go, so we'll bring it to a close.
Yeah, rites of passage are something that was studied, again, around the same time as adolescence got coined as a word 115 years ago. A guy named Arnold Van Gennep, a cultural anthropologist, studied indigenous societies, especially religious pilgrimages, and what he found was there are sort of three phases of a rite of passage. And then that was popularized by a guy named Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey. And in fact, the Star Wars movies by George Lucas were based upon Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey. And the premise is that there's this sort of severance from the past. Again, the butterfly caterpillar to butterfly is also an example of this. There's the severance from the past of who you were. Then you go off into this new place that's liminal and, often full of challenges. and then you come back to the community as in a new form. I mean, think of going into the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you leave your family, you get your head shaved, you end up in boot camp, you go through a year being a plebe, you know, being sort of like the lowest on the totem pole, and you start building this identity of being a military person, and then you come back into society as that new person. So that's another way to look at it. And rites of passage, one of the things that's really relevant about this is we as society have tended to help people go through rites of passage during transitional times of their lives. And if you look at indigenous societies like the Native Americans or in Africa or in certain parts of Asia like Bali, they have rites of passage at particularly important periods of people's lives. We sort of have it in the U.S. too. I mean, a wedding is a rite of passage,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's a transitional time where you're committing yourself and you're going to live with someone else. You know, and in puberty, we have bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and in the Latino society or Latin society, or we have quinceañeras. And even, frankly, going from adolescence to adulthood, you have a graduation ceremony, graduating from childhood,
mm-hmm.
a commencement ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Commencement actually takes you into adulthood.
Right, the commencement of adulthood, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have that in midlife, though.
That's
There's nothing
right.
like that.
Yeah, and what we used to have was the gold watch at retirement, and that was it.
Yes, that's right. As if, you know, somehow, and again, that was all premised on the idea that somebody stays in their job for 40 years, and then they, you know, earn the gold watch at the end. You know, frankly, at that point in their life, they don't really want to look at their watch anymore because the watch is, time is, you know, in the old days, time had become their enemy. You know, I don't really necessarily want to see that, you know, what's happening with time. I don't know. There's clearly a better rite of passage out there than a gold watch.
Yeah. Talk just a little bit about what Mary Catherine Bateson has to say about this and how it applies both to your mm-hmm. book and to the Academy.
So Mary Catherine Bateson was the daughter of Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson. Margaret Mead, a cultural anthropologist, Gregory Bateson, a well-known psychologist. And she wrote a book and talked about the idea of a midlife atrium. So instead of this extra longevity you mentioned at the early part of the show, instead of it being almost like you've built this extra bedroom or two bedrooms on the back of your house, which if you were to think about that as a metaphor in your own life, would be you get more time at age. You know, you're living longer, so you're older longer.
Yeah, right.
So you're decrepit and diseased longer. Well, that's not really how this longevity thing's working. The way it's working is people are actually healthy and, frankly, in midlife longer. The period of midlife has expanded. And what that means to me is not that we're building a couple extra bedrooms on the back of the house. Instead, what it means is we're actually building an atrium in the middle of the house. And Mary Catherine Bateson calls us the midlife atrium. And what she means is that in our 40s and 50s, maybe it's a time we're supposed to reflect, like you might on an atrium where there's air and sun and light coming in so you can reflect on what's next for yourself. Now, most of us don't think of that way in our 40s and 50s. It's like you're sort of on a path and you don't have time to do that. And yet, I think this idea of a midlife atrium or even a gap year in midlife is not a bad thing because, as you said earlier, if you're 55 years old and you're going to live another 40 years, you're actually not even halfway through
adult life.
Your
yeah.
adulthood if you start counting at age 18. So because of that, we need to recognize, my God, my life's going to be a lot different in the future, but we don't prepare people for how they can curate their life in that way.
Yeah. Now, the reason that I reached out to you, Chip, was that I do think this is something which is bigger than people realize, more prevalent than people realize. As you have pointed out elsewhere, the opioid crisis, the suicides at this midlife when people lose a job and the jobs that are now available, they are not suited for. So if we are moving, adding 10 years to our life, but power is moving younger and younger because it's technological power in the business world, this is a challenge. And I think your thinking and your book and your academy speak to that challenge.
Got it. Thank you.
The book is Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. The website is chipconley.com. And if you have any last words you want to offer?
Well, you know, all I can say is we would love to have you join us at the Modern Elder Academy. We offer all kinds of beautiful scholarships. So it's a socio-economic diverse place and a social enterprise. But if you don't want to do that much of a commitment of coming down for a week, read the book. And I think you'll find that it will give you a new sense of the aspirational nature of moving into elderhood.
Very good. Thank you, Chip Connelly, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Tim.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. So that's terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, one word, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's all one word, a world that just might work. And they're the same website. Now, if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus I usually put in 8 to 10 articles that flesh out the conversation we're having, plus some things that I think are relevant, timely, and maybe even attention-getting in terms of what's wrong and solutions that are happening, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast at Apple Podcasts and many other podcast sites. Some of you may still look at Apple Podcasts as iTunes. That works as well. And you can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence, M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.